From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Say It Ain't So, Bigger and Bigger Poppy. Ahead on Only a Game, fallout from the news that the Red Sox David Ortiz is on the notorious list of 104 Major League ballplayers who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in 2003. Also, Lou Holtz comes out of retirement in Japan and the ups and downs of golfer Michelle Wee. Also ahead, a father and son from Virginia fish 50 waters in 50 states in 50 days.
How often do you have that conversation at home with your children where you say, well, how's your day? Fine. Anything new happen? No. And so we are giving ourselves an opportunity to have 50 days of experiences that will give us something to go back to for the rest of our lives.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday afternoon, the Boston Red Sox beat the Oakland Athletics 8-5, which was not the big baseball news in Boston that day. Just before the game began, the New York Times reported that Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz, a.k.a. Big Poppy, were on the list of 104 players who had tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs back in 2003. Outside Fenway Park, a couple of fans were asked if that news tainted the World Series championship the Red Sox had won in 2004, the team's first in 86 years.
You gotta say it does. You gotta say it.
You can also say that every championship in the last 20 years is tainted, and because so many people have been named on these lists.
Yeah, you could say that too.
And what else can you say? That David Ortiz, a folk hero to some, and a guy who said last spring that he thought steroid users ought to be banned for an entire season, is a fraud? Joining me now to discuss baseball's most recent bad news is Tony Maserati of the Boston Globe. Tony, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
The revelation that Manny Ramirez tested positive in 2003 is one thing. He's already served a 50-game suspension this season, and so nobody perhaps was surprised. But to what extent is the appearance of David Ortiz's name on that list a different sort of story?
Actually, as far as Red Sox fans are concerned, they're both relevant, because certainly the one argument they had with regard to Ramirez anyway was that there was no proof that he had tested positive or taken any type of performance-enhancing substances when he was with the Red Sox. We now know that to be true as well. But in Ortiz's case, I think if you look at all the people who have tested positive or been found to have taken substances during what is clearly the most tainted era in baseball history, I think Ortiz probably is the guy that stands out as being the most popular among the fans and the media. And I think that's where the real damage in this story comes from. We all would have been naive to think that the Red Sox played during that era without having their own share of guys and issues with regard to steroids and performance enhancers. But again, we're talking about probably the biggest and most adored figure on those teams. And during that run in particular, Ortiz was larger than life.
Players tested in 2003 were told that no names would be attached to the results because the testing was solely to determine the need for new doping rules. So to what extent are David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, Alex Rodriguez, and all the others who have been named victims?
Well, I think there's a certain truth to that element. There's no question about that, and I think they have a right to be angry. It's why the union was resisting that process at the very outset. But I also think that part of the reason this mushroomed into what it did, Bill, is because the union was so resistant that they ended up penalizing the members of their constituency that are clean. As for the leaking, I understand players would be frustrated and angry about that. I also think that informational leaks are something that our society relies on in order to get the bottom of the story. Without anonymous sources, we might never have found out about Watergate.
Tony, perhaps it's naive to suggest this, but would it be a good idea if the Players Association and the league were to agree now that full disclosure of that entire list of 104 players would be in everybody's best interest?
So I felt that from the beginning. In fact, when Alex Rodriguez was identified, I thought it was completely unfair to him. I thought he was being made a scapegoat for all of the players that tested during that period, and he was being penalized largely because he was the best player on the list. So my answer to that is yes. And in all honesty, if this is going to keep happening every few months where a name or two gets leaked out that's on that list of 104, I just assume we do them all at once, find out who they are, and move on. I think everybody feels that way. The union, I'm sure, does not. But I'd be willing to bet at this stage if you took a vote among the union players that the ones who are not on there certainly be willing to have it done because we're all tired of dealing with this topic, and we are certainly tired of this coming up over and over again. I think the fans are tired of it, too.
There has been some speculation that the news about Big Poppy broke a lot of hearts in Boston and elsewhere. But when he hit a home run Thursday afternoon, Ortiz was cheered mightily at Fenway Park. Is his life in Boston and beyond likely to change?
I've always questioned whether the fans really cared about this as much as the media does. And as a member of the media, and given the magnitude of the story and the scandal, I think we now have an obligation to report it when we find out that someone was on that list or when someone used performance enhancers. I believe that. But I also think that fans are loyal to the uniform. If David Ortiz played for the Yankees, they'd boo him. But he doesn't. So the fans of Fenway are going to cheer for him. And it really comes down to the uniform more than it does the player. But he's obviously accomplished a great deal in Boston, and they're very loyal to him.
Fairly shortly after the news broke on Thursday, Bronson Arroyo, a former Boston pitcher now with the Cincinnati Reds, announced that he wouldn't be surprised if his name were to appear on that 2003 list. Do you think various other players will be saying something similar to that in the wake of Thursday's news?
I do. It wouldn't surprise me. And Arroyo's claim was that he was taking a substance that might have been tainted or laced with performance enhancers, unbeknownst to him. Look, I suppose there's always that possibility. I suspect that the large majority of the players that are on that list already know it. And I don't know if a statement like the one Arroyo made is an alibi, again, a preemptive strike. It could be any one of those things. But there are at least 100 other names out there. And how players want to accept responsibility for that or not, it could come in a variety of ways. But, yeah, I fully expect that it wouldn't surprise me if David Ortiz comes out and says that he took a supplement that was laced that he didn't know about. So, you know, again, it all comes down to what the credibility is and whether we believe them.
Tony Maserati covers baseball for the Boston Globe. Tony, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks a lot. Take care.
Football isn't the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Japanese sports, but it turns out there are more than 200 college and semi-pro teams that play there. Last week, Japan's national football team suited up against the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame legends. Akiko Fujita explains why Coach Lou Holtz and some of his gridiron alumni came out of retirement for one last game.
It felt like any other fall Saturday in South Bend. The marching band decked in Irish green. Players strapping on those gold helmets, fists pounding against their chests.
Let's go Irish! Let's go Irish!
But when game time arrived for the 2009 Notre Dame Japan Bowl, it wasn't current head coach Charlie Weiss leading his team on the field, but former coach Lou Holtz. No sight of 2009 starting quarterback Jimmy Clausen, but there was Tony Rice, the starting quarterback of Notre Dame's last national championship team 21 years ago.
I'm Merton.
That's Chris Haynes, a wide receiver from the 1977 national championship team. The 52-year-old teacher smiled as he paced the sidelines, high-fiving other former Irish players who were just as excited as he was to play another game. It didn't matter that they were more than 6,000 miles away from Touchdown Jesus. Playing inside the half-empty Tokyo Dome, better known for baseball than football. This was a friendly exhibition game to celebrate 75 years of Japanese football, and Holtz said the call to come out of retirement was non-negotiable.
And when Notre Dame asked me to do something, I'd do it. I mean, that's just a lady on the dome. It's like my wife.
Members of Japan's all-star team, including linebacker Naoki Kosho, called the game a dream matchup.
I feel that the 60 members on our team are the happiest football players in the world.
The Notre Dame game was a major event for a sport that hasn't grabbed many headlines in Japan. Despite its seven-decade history, there's no professional football league like baseball and soccer. 60 company-sponsored teams play in the semi-pro X-League, where teams fill stands with free tickets and players suit up after a long day at the office. Even young boys interested in football don't have a national youth league like Pop Warner. Waseda University coach Tak Asakura says the lack of exposure has made the sport a hard sell at the college level.
American football rules are like, 分かりづらいみたいで.
Students think the rules are hard to understand, he says, and adds students in Japan can only commit to one sport a year. Football isn't the first choice for most. Still, college coaches like Asakura have pushed hard in recent years to improve their player skills. The coach sends a handful of players to the University of Southern California spring practice every year, while rival schools partner with other BCS programs like Oklahoma and Ohio State.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Going back, 2 feet in, let's go!
A few weeks ago, USC sent defensive line coach Jethro Franklin to Waseda's campus in a Tokyo suburb. He put on a two-day clinic that tested the players' skills and attitude.
What time is it?
Yeah, they may not be the biggest guys or the fastest guys, but they make up for it by the mental part of the game.
Japanese players are starting to prove that. At the American Football World Cup 2 years ago, the national team nearly upset the U.S. The group made up of college players won by a field goal in double overtime. Holt said he studied that game to prepare for the 2009 Japan Bowl.
Japan outplayed them. Japan was the superior team. So based on that, they're a Division I college football team.
That praise didn't translate to success at the Tokyo Dome on Saturday. Team Japan got on the board first with a first quarter field goal, but Notre Dame dominated the rest of the game. They gained 309 yards on the ground on the way to a 19-3 victory.
Be proud of yourself. I'm proud of the coach.
After the game, Holt addressed Japanese players on the field, praising their improvements and pledging to help in the future. Head coach Kiyoki Mori said he appreciated the gesture, but he wasn't into moral victories. Team Japan will get its shot at international revenge 2 years from now when Austria hosts the Football World Cup. That's also the year when all Japanese students will begin playing flag football at elementary schools. That would give the sport the exposure Mori says it desperately needs. And if Team Japan performs big on the global stage, it could mark the beginning of the country's emergence in football. For Only a Game, I'm Akiko Fujita in Tokyo.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Tough? I'll show you tough. How about a 6-mile course containing 21 obstacles, including burning tires, a pond filled with leeches, and a 40-foot-high wall? That's not enough for you? Okay, let's toss in a pit filled shoulder-high with mud. Crawl through that, tough guy. Nearly 3,000 men and women took on those challenges in the Tough Guy Race at South Purton Farm in Wolverhampton on Sunday, some of them emerging with sprains, burns, and cuts. The first to cross the finish line was James Appleton of Cambridge, who crossed the line in 1 hour, 39 minutes, feeling tired but exceedingly tough. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the rise and fall and possible rise again of golfer Michelle Wee. But first, tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of heavyweight wrestler Jeff Blatnick's gold medal at the Olympic Games in Los Angeles, though most observers of the 1984 Summer Games remember the performances of Mary Lou Retton and Carl Lewis. Those who witnessed Blatnick's victory saw one of the most dramatic comebacks in Olympic history. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
Jeff Blatnick prowls the padded floor of a gym in Binghamton, New York, where he coaches a summer wrestling camp for high school kids.
Have a plan of attack. You're reaching for a hand, looking for a two-on-one, looking for a snap.
He's a big man in his 50s now, with gray hair and a big Rorschach blot of sweat on his T-shirt. He moves to clinch with a heavyweight wrestler a third his age. Greco-Roman wrestling is a particular art. Everything below the waist is off-limit. It's a game of upper body strength and judo-like throws. Blatnick shifts his weight with quick, almost delicate movements of his feet. His hands snake for control. This is the technique that once made him one of the most dangerous wrestlers in the world.
It's hard to believe it was 25 years ago. And in a sense, that almost makes it certain that you'll never have that same energy level again for the rest of your life.
Blatnick took up the sport later than most wrestlers in his early 20s after a coach noticed his powerful build and his quickness. It was a perfect fit, and by the late 1970s, Blatnick was convinced that he could be one of the first Americans to beat the European wrestlers at their own game.
We hosted the Winter Olympics, and there was the euphoria over the Miracle on Ice, and we just kind of looked at each other when that moment happened, thinking, you know, come July, it's going to be our turn for this little miracle.
But even as the U.S. hockey team was toppling the Soviets in Lake Placid in February of 1980, plans for the Summer Games were going awry.
I can't say at this moment what other nations will not go to the Summer Olympics in Moscow. Ours will not go.
President Jimmy Carter announced that the U.S. would boycott the Summer Games following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
I understand how you feel, and I thought about it a lot as we approach this moment. Knowing what the Olympics mean to you, to know that you would be disappointed, it's not a pleasant time for me.
Blatnick and his teammates were furious. He still says the boycott was a mistake.
There was talk, you know, hey, maybe we'll fly to Hungary and backdoor it into Russia. And there was talk of, you know, defying your country. And then they yanked their passports, so that kind of ended all that.
Blatnick was still young enough to make the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles. But in February of 1982, he was showering after a workout and noticed something strange on his neck.
I really didn't believe it in the beginning, but I had these bumps. They were getting bigger. They were getting more numerous. And, you know, it scared me.
Diagnosed with a type of cancer called Hodgkin's lymphoma, Blatnick began a crushing treatment of surgery and radiation.
The first time I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror, and you see stitch, staple, staple, stitch, staple, staple, the length of my belly. This is one of those things you go to sleep and you wake up changed. It's all there is. And you hope that when you wake up and the change has occurred that it's something you can handle.
Blatnick's spleen had been removed. His stomach muscles were shredded. Coming back from that kind of trauma is challenging for anyone, and many assumed it would be impossible for Blatnick to regain his Olympic form. But with doctors still drawing magic marker diagrams on his body to map new rounds of radiation therapy, Blatnick headed back into the gym. He still didn't feel 100% healthy until the winter of 1984, and at national trials, he barely made the Olympic team.
They're going crazy here at the Anaheim Convention Center. It's the heavyweight division, the 100-plus kilo division, Greco-Roman-style wrestling. Jeff Blatnick, 27 years old, who's connected...
But in Los Angeles, Blatnick grappled his way to the championship match against Thomas Johansson, a wrestler from Sweden who outweighed him by 35 pounds. Here's the play-by-play on ABC Sports.
Upper body, he's trying to use a shrug. Blatnick would like to move behind this big man, just step behind one of those arms and move behind. Johansson moving, trying to come up on top, didn't make it, still no score.
The match looked like a dead tie in the first round. Johansson's bulk balanced against Blatnick's speed.
And down on the mat. Well, the crowd is getting into this match now with a minute 10 left with that USA chant. He's got a lock! And he took him down with the inside. Yes.
All right. Then in the second round, the Swede tired, and Blatnick scored the first point on a takedown.
He dropped his head. And I just said, I gotcha. Gotcha.
And that's it. And look at Jeff Blatnick. Overcome by emotion, he has won the gold medal for the United States of America. These fans at the Anaheim Convention Center giving him a standing ovation.
Harry Brands won an Olympic bronze medal at the 2000 Sydney Summer Games and now coaches the vaunted wrestling program at the University of Iowa. He says Blatnick's win inspired a generation of wrestlers.
Well, I can remember it distinctly. I was going to be a sophomore in high school, and I remember you know, watching him with the flag, and even, you know, the story about the sickness and the and how he overcame that, and the fight that comes along with that, and that wrestler's mentality. That was his chance to win, and he didn't wait around.
In the quarter century since that moment, Blatnik has survived a second round of cancer. He was also one of the first promoters of a new sport that was called ultimate fighting, until Blatnik coined the phrase mixed martial arts. Here he is calling a 1995 UFC match.
Oh, and he's got a hold of Radicia's leg. Let's see what he can do with it. Whoa. Radicia now has an opportunity to throw some punches. There's some distance between their heads.
After a long hiatus, Blatnik will judge a mixed martial arts bout in August. But these days, he spends most of his time in the gym coaching traditional wrestling, in clinics, and at a public high school in Burnt Hills, New York. Greco-Roman wrestling will never be a huge ratings draw. But Blatnik says sponsorships and public interest and America's ability to compete changed dramatically after that summer in 1984.
From that point on, suddenly there was a McDonald's commercial, which shows a kid doing thing, you know, future sprinter, future high jumper, shows a kid grabbing a teddy bear, future Greco-Roman wrestler. So the word got out. It was nice to kind of be on that wave when it finally broke.
A quarter century after his win, Jeff Blatnik still hasn't been inducted into the U.S. Olympics Hall of Fame. He's been nominated four times, but when the 2009 inductees were named in early July, Blatnik wasn't on the list. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Binghamton, New York.
When Michelle Wee was 11, she could hit a golf ball 300 yards. At 13, she became the youngest girl ever to win a U.S. Golf Association event. But that's nothing. At 10, she had expressed a desire to play in and win the Masters tournament, and she said she thought she would be able to beat Tiger Woods by the time she was 15. Yet Michelle Wee, now 19, has not yet won a single LPGA tournament, though she has earned nearly $500,000 on the tour this summer. This weekend, she's playing in the Women's British Open. In his new book, The Sure Thing, The Making and Unmaking of Golf Phenom Michelle Wee, Eric Adelson, who first interviewed Wee when she was 10, examines the career of the young woman who may yet turn out to be the female Tiger Woods. He joins me from WUCF in Orlando. Eric, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You were not initially eager to interview a 10-year-old golfer, but once you did, what impressed you about Michelle Wee?
Well, what was so interesting about that conversation was that she said she liked golf, but she didn't really elaborate. And then I thought to ask, well, what's a typical day like for you? What do you do every day? And she went into a discussion of Digimon and Pokemon and Laura Ingalls Wilder and Jelly Roll pens and and her love of fluffy dogs, but not amphibians. She was extremely excited to talk about the rest of her life, more so than she was talking about golf. And she was very certain about what her future would hold. When I asked her in jest, do you think you could beat Tiger Woods? And she said, yeah, maybe by the time I'm 15. And I listened for a hint of a laugh. There wasn't.
No laugh. You write of Wee that as a 12-year-old, she, quote, ushered in excitement about the future of women's golf that had never before existed. Why was that?
Well, it was the kind of fan that she attracted. It wasn't the typical women's golf fan. It was a grown men who wanted to see how she hit the ball so far. It was a multiracial, diverse group of people who just wanted to see her and see someone so tall. She had a presence when she walked into a room. And it was also a younger demographic. It was little girls who thought she was cool and teenage boys who thought she was hot.
In her earliest tournaments, Michelle Wee's caddy was her father. Is it fair to say that B.J. Wee didn't know as much about golf as he thought he did?
Yeah, he took up golf late in his life relatively. His wife was a golf star over in Korea, but he inserted himself as caddy right away, and he never had a trace of uncertainty about him. He felt that he could understand the slope of any green at any time. And so he wrote a book full of arrows for Michelle to consult. And she was to consult that no matter what the situation in terms of early or late in the day or rain or sunshine. And he absolutely believed in what he knew about where the putt would go. And so did she.
Before she had even turned 16, Michelle Wee had gotten exemptions to play in several tournaments against male professionals. She and her father wanted her to be the first female to make the cut in a PGA event since Babe Didrikson-Zaharias did that more than half a century ago. Why did they go that route rather than arrange for her to start by playing against the best female golfers in the world?
Well, I think that that was something that Michelle wanted to do from the beginning. She played baseball against the boys when she was 6 years old and did very well. She loved crushing the ball. She could hit the ball extremely far, much farther than anybody her age, boy or girl. She practiced against boys. So a lot of people feel that this was some sort of marketing ploy to get money, and it certainly made her millions. But I do think, based on my conversations with her really from the beginning, that she felt that there was no reason why she shouldn't play against boys, just like she did in other sports all the time.
As you say, as a youngster, Michelle Wee was already making millions of dollars, and that certainly is one measure of success. But at what point did it begin to become evident that the Michelle Wee Express had jumped the tracks?
Well, for so long, it was all about her promise and her potential and what she could do. People imagined what it would be like when she was 19, 20, 24 years old. Even she imagined that. It was all about the future. But as soon as they signed that contract and turned pro, then it wasn't about promise or potential anymore. It was about performance. And people didn't ask, what will she do? People started asking, well, what has she done to earn this money? And I think that she really felt that pressure very suddenly. I think her father felt a lot of that pressure immediately upon turning pro. And really the thrust of the book is what happened at that turning point when she signed that contract at 15. And then all of a sudden, there were still people who just wanted to see her play, but there were a lot more people who were looking very hard at her scores that didn't really care before.
Though she played in lots of LPGA tournaments via exemptions when she was 14 and 15 years old before she turned pro, based on what you've written, it doesn't seem as if Michelle Wee made friends on the women's tour. Why was that?
There was a lot of resentment. There was a lot of jealousy. I mean, here's somebody who wasn't a member of the tour, who got all the ratings, all the media attention, a lot of money just by showing up, where a lot of the successful golfers didn't make that money even by winning. And you know, it's interesting, Bill, because a lot of people were upset at Annika Sörenstam at first when she said that she was going to go and play against the men one time at Colonial. And people don't really remember that there was some resentment of her too. But once she did and was successful and came back and drew ratings for the tour, then people backed off and said, well, it's a good thing. Michelle got the resentment, but when she couldn't make a cut, and when she kept trying to go for the men's tour, and when she didn't become a member, then the resentment lingered and I think grew.
At one point a couple of years ago, Michelle Wee had played 24 consecutive rounds of golf without breaking par. She blamed her performance on injury, but was that the whole story?
I don't think it was the whole story. It was certainly a part of the story. She didn't let on how much pain she was in. She told me even earlier this year that she was taking a lot of painkillers, so many that she had developed some stomach ailments and had to take stomach pills on top of the painkillers. There was certainly some of that. But I think also that there was the mental weight of seeing the galleries thinning out and people watching her and the disappointment. And also she had so many troubles with her putting. A lot of that was because she didn't listen to her caddy. Her caddy wasn't allowed to help her. And so I think a lot of that dates all the way back to when she was a preteen, where she could hit the ball really far and people were very excited about the distance. And people didn't really pay attention to putting. And putting was something that she didn't really care about at first. It was just crushing the ball, which everybody loved and praised her for. But again, when it comes time to actually score and win, you have to be good around the greens. And she was too young and inexperienced, but that wasn't enough of an excuse for her critics.
I'm speaking with Eric Adelson, author of The Sure Thing. You are listening to Only a Game. Last year, Michelle Wee backtracked, went to Q School, and won her card as a member of the LPGA Tour. Did she have any other choice at that point?
No, nobody would take her. The PGA events felt it was too much of a sideshow, and she was finishing with really high scores. Earlier in her career, there were sponsors that were extremely intent on getting her on the course, and those sponsors had backed off. There was resentment from the LPGA itself. So really, she had nowhere to go, and if she wanted in on any tournament, she would have to go the traditional way and get her card, and I think it was healthy for her to do so, but I think that if she had any other choice, if she had other doors open, she would have walked through those instead.
That's amazing. She still would have gone the alternative route had there been such.
And she still would. I mean, she's never backed down from that, Bill. From the time she was 10 years old and even now, I asked her, okay, is the men's thing over? No, she very much wants to play against the men. And I think that if there's any chance for her to do so in the future, no matter what's happened in the past, in her high scores and her miscuts and all the criticism, I think she would do that. That's something that she's never strayed from. And I really do believe that in her heart, she thinks that she is going to do well on the LPGA Tour, get that buzz back, get the acclaim back, and go against the men again if she can.
Michelle Wee has also left the management company, which was marketing her as a celebrity and as an entertainer rather than as a golfer, and she switched to a representative favored by lots of athletes. Has she rediscovered her dedication to golf?
That is a question I don't know that there's a good answer to. There's a lot of rounds where she still seems like she's not happy to be out there. There are times when she said that she wondered if it was worth it. She isn't really obsessed with golf the way that a lot of athletes are, where that's all they think about and all they talk about. And when it comes time to retire, they can't face that. I really honestly think it could go either way. If she wins a tournament and gets some confidence and momentum, I think the old Michelle can come back. But I think that if it remains frustrating, it's going to be a little bit harder for her to continue, because her goal was always been to make history and to turn heads and to, in her own words, make people think. I think that goal is really about breaking barriers, not about winning.
Eric Adelson is the author of The Sure Thing, The Making and Unmaking of Golf Phenom Michelle Wee, which is published by ESPN Books. He joined me from WUCF in Orlando. Eric, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Be prepared is a motto as appropriate to athletes as it is to the Boy Scouts. But in a recent match at the Bournemouth Cricket Club, an 18-year-old lad named Ed failed to abide by said motto. When it was his turn to take up the cricket bat, young Ed was discovered to be lacking his pants. He raced onto the pitch to take up his post anyway, only to be sent back for taking more than 3 minutes to get to the wicket. Despite the setback, Ed's team, Bournemouth, managed to achieve a draw in the match, after which the Bournemouth captain said, "It's something I had never seen before in my life, and I'm sure a lot of cricketers would probably say the same."
Now the devil has a player.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a father and son find each other fishing from coast to coast. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
I'm glad to see that you made it safely past the smoldering ruins of Red Sox Nation. on Thursday, the New York Times reported that David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez are both on the formerly anonymous list of dopers from 2003. I know you're of the mind that those results should never have been released. Now they have been. Should Sox fans feel a little less smug about the 2004 and 2007 championship?
Well, you know what? I have declared myself a long time ago a conscientious objector in this particular war. So, I mean, it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. I think any Red Sox fans who gloated about the various people who turned out allegedly to have done this on the 98 to 2000 Yankee teams should probably feel pretty bad today. I think David Ortiz should feel pretty bad for coming out in public and being very outspoken against it. But quite honestly, this is, to me, another demonstration of the fact that any union that agrees to drug testing on the grounds that it will remain forever anonymous is playing its members for suckers. You cannot trust the anonymity of the testing. Therefore, the testing is next to worthless.
Charlie, for weeks there's been speculation that baseball's defending champions, the Phillies, would acquire another accomplished pitcher, and this week they did. So, do you anticipate success for Cliff Lee in Philadelphia?
Well, that was the only hole that they had in their lineup as defending World Series champions. They're going to be a terrific team the rest of the way. This is the best trade made prior to the real kind of home stretch of the trade deadline on Friday.
Other winners and losers with regard to baseball trades?
Well, I mean, the Pittsburgh Pirates continue to be losers because every time they have a player with any promise, they shuffle them out of town and then, you know, sit back in their easy chairs, pour themselves a cold drink, and chuckle softly themselves what suckers the people in Pittsburgh are for building a new stadium for an ownership that has no intention of ever winning.
White Sox pitcher Mark Burley demonstrated this week that a really good way to begin your quest to set the major league record for consecutive batters retired is to throw a perfect game. How close did he come to consecutive perfect games?
Well, he came within 10 outs of it. He retired the first 17 Twins in his next start, which pushed him past a record of 41 straight. It was set actually by two people, which was kind of funny. Jim Barr of the Giants in 1972 and a reliever named Bobby Jenks, who probably had to take a lot longer to do it. This was edging toward the great Johnny Vandermeer record of consecutive no-hitters, although this would have been infinitely better.
Too bad retiring 17 consecutive Twins doesn't count as 34 guys.
See, now we have listeners there. The Twins are good.
The chief executive of the NFL Players Union says that in the next round of contract talks, he wants to take up the matter of how much authority Commissioner Roger Goodell should be able to exercise. To what extent is this a function of Mr. Goodell's disciplining of Michael Vick?
I think it's a function of his disciplining of everybody since he got in there. The man has made Pete Rozelle look like Dorothy Day at this point. And I think that now that you have a chief...
That's a good one.
Now that you have a union chief executive in Demoris Smith, who's going to be a little bit less of an ownership puppet than the late Gene Upshaw was, this may well be a crucial point and a very tough point to negotiate in the upcoming talks.
Charlie, times are tough everywhere, especially in arena football, where the Albany Firebirds got into the playoffs because the Florida Fire Cats ran out of money. What happened to the idea that teams could make up for hard times by selling tickets to postseason games?
I have no idea, but apparently I have to keep the fire teams here straight. The Fire Cats owe the league about $200,000 and therefore were not allowed to be in the Arena 2 playoffs. Whatever happened to the great example of the Pittsburgh Penguins, who went bankrupt and got better?
Plaxico Burress, the former New York Giants receiver who accidentally shot himself in the leg in a nightclub last November, expressed remorse before a grand jury this week. I can understand his expressing remorse. What I don't understand is how he can be remorseful and also not guilty.
Well, he says he's very sorry for accidentally shooting himself in the leg and glad he's very sorry he may have endangered other people, but he really isn't guilty of endangering other people, so he should be set free. This is a big high-stakes roll of the dice for him to try to stay out of jail.
Since former NBA star Stephon Marbury started streaming his life live on the internet, he has eaten Vaseline, broken out in tears, and told viewers that he saw Jesus in his shower. His bizarre behavior has caused many to call his life a train wreck, but I beg to differ.
Actually, it's a car accident, Bill.
Don't worry about it. There ain't nothing but the devil. Don't worry about it. You did that.
I did that.
Go. It ain't nothing but the devil.
Please tell me that he didn't just drive away from the scene of an automobile accident while streaming live on the internet.
That's exactly what he did, Bill. Who's ever going to find him? Who will ever know?
There's certainly no record of all
this. Wait, there he goes. The guy that ate the Vaseline. I know him.
Okay, quiz time, Charlie. Which prominent NBA player recently texted soccer's most recognizable celebrity as follows? Quote, David Beckham, I know you hear me. Don't be scared. Don't make me call you out. You will never score a goal on me.
Shaquille O'Neal, who is already shaping up to have the most enjoyable and hilarious post-playing career of any athlete ever, is doing this show called Shaq Versus, where he takes on different athletes at their own game. He wants to play goalie, and he wants Beckham to shoot at him. And he's thrown it down, and of course via Twitter, which means he's not throwing it down in any language known to anybody with a functioning frontal lobe. But nonetheless, this may actually happen.
Charlie, last week you suggested that swimmers should be able to wear whatever they want in the pool. I'm wondering if you've changed your mind after Ricky Barron's swimsuit malfunction at the World Swimming Championships on Sunday.
Well, the new suit was very effective at helping you set world records, but not very effective at staying on your body. And the back of Ricky's suit had a bit of a malfunction as he dove into the pool.
Oops.
He kind of freaked out for a second. He said he was putting on a very good show. Well, yes, you were, but not exactly what the swimming people had in mind.
We thought it was a big deal when 25 world records were broken in Beijing, but 29 world records fell in just the first 5 days in Rome at those championships, mostly due to the high-tech suits, which will soon be banned. Is it time to start talking asterisks?
No. Why? Again, I want someone to tell me how this is different from fiberglass pole vaulting poles, which I heard the same complaints about in the 1970s, which revolutionized the sport. Yeah, your records fall. You know what? That's what happens to records. Whether it happens quickly or slowly, it doesn't matter. This is not a performance-enhancing drug. Anybody can get these suits. The fact that they make you swim faster, well, of course they do. This is technology marching on. And if somebody can tell me how this differs in kind from fiberglass pole vaulting poles, I'll change my mind.
And finally, Monopoly players are used to hearing the phrase, go directly to jail, Charlie, but is it safe to say that 54-year-old Kenneth Repke took that phrase a little bit too seriously?
Yeah, his opponent refused to sell him Park Place and Boardwalk, so he punched her in the head. They should send him to jail, and they shouldn't put him in a cell. They should put him in a tiny shoe.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His new book is Idiot America. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game, and I thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On the morning of June 13th, Jeff Turner of Warrenton, Virginia, and his 17-year-old son Taylor fished the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania and caught nothing. That in itself was not newsworthy, but what they did over the following 49 days certainly was. After Thursday's excursion for blue marlin off Hawaii's Kona coast, the Turners had succeeded in their quest to fish 50 waters in 50 states in 50 days. Along their circuitous route, the father and son duo tallied a staggering 956 fish, raised money for various charities, and emphasized via their website the importance of the father-son relationship. Last week, Only a Game's Gary Wallach met with the Turners on the 40th day and in the 43rd state of what they call their epic father-son adventure, and he has this report.
I'm 37 fish up on Taylor as of this morning, and he is vowing that by state number 50, he's going to catch me. So
I definitely will. There's no doubt in my mind I'm going to catch him.
On a slightly overcast Wednesday morning, red-tailed hawks ride thermals over the Pioneer Valley, while kingfishers and swallows dip and dive in the cooler air just above a riffled stretch of the Deerfield River in Florida, Massachusetts. Looking a bit anxious and more than a little tired, Jeff and Taylor Turner grab their spinning rods and fish from the bank while their guide for the day readies a raft. Taylor especially can't wait to have at the Deerfield's rumored trout.
Got one.
You got one on the first cast?
This is the second cast. It's good enough, though.
Perhaps we'll just stand here all day and you guys can catch trout in this pool.
Jim Dowd, a professional guide representing local outfitter Zor Outdoor, has donated his services in support of the Turner's quest. Dowd has guided on the Deerfield for over 30 years, but even he gets a little starry-eyed when contemplating the scope of Jeff and Taylor's 50-day undertaking.
Frankly, I'm envious. I think it's a marvelous idea, and I think these fellows are to be congratulated for coming up with it and planning it so well, and I'm really pleased and honored to be a small part of it.
After a few more minutes of fidgeting and preparation, the guide and his two anglers shove off.
Okay, we're good to go.
At the end of a 3.5-hour float over the river's dark pools and whitewater, the Turners and their guide pull the raft up on a shady bank, where Jeff offers his assessment of the day's fishing.
I think it was really good. I mean, we caught 18 trout, and we caught rainbows, we caught browns, wild ones, stocked ones. Caught one brook trout. Some of them were big fish. So from an East Coast trout fishery, I think this is world class.
What led you to decide that fishing 50 states in 50 days would be a good idea?
For me, it's more of a philosophical thing. I read this book by John Eldridge called Wild at Heart about 8 years ago, and he has this quote from that book, and he says, "Deep in his heart, every man longs for a battle to fight, an adventure to live, and a beauty to rescue. And so we as men, I think, throughout our lives start to lose passion. We start to lose focus on what really would be an incredible adventure for us. Our careers get in our way of doing things like this. And I think I just threw the question out to Taylor last June, and I said, what would you think if we fished all 50 states or something like that?
Yeah. It's kind of hard to turn down, huh, Taylor?
Yeah. At the time, I thought it was a pretty good idea. But I'm not sure if I really wanted to be in an RV for that long. Probably like 2 weeks would have been nice time, but it's been a lot of fun. We've done a lot of cool stuff, got a lot of good fish.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people think we're on a 50-day vacation, and in some respects it might be kind of like that. In more ways than one, it's work. It's a lot of long hours and windshield time and some boredom. You know, you're doing the same thing over and over. But what's really neat about fishing 50 states in 50 days is there's novelty every single day, and there's something new to explore that we've never seen before. And even the windshield time has been good from those perspectives. We've seen just amazing sights and that we've never would have seen before together.
You say that one of your goals is to encourage fathers and sons to rebuild their fractured relationships. In what specific ways do you feel that the father-son relationship is fractured?
We tend not to make ourselves available anymore for our children. We make ourselves available 24/7 for our employer. We always keep our BlackBerries on. That thing is always ready to go off at a moment's notice. And I think because of that, we're not purposeful in our thinking about doing things of interest, building relationships. So the key in life, I think, with our children is to try to get beyond how's the weather. You know, how often do you have that conversation at home with your children where you say, well, how was your day? Fine. Anything new happen? No. What's going on? Nothing. And so my feeling about this trip and that we are giving ourselves an opportunity to have 50 days of beyond the weather experiences that will give us something to go back to for the rest of our lives.
You've posted videos at each stop along the way, and you've invited people to email you. Have you heard from people as you've toured the country? And what are they saying about your trip?
Yeah, we get like 50 emails a day probably. They're usually very positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really amazing. It's not just fathers talking about memories of their own parents or memories of their children, but it's even women and ladies in their 40s and 50s and 60s who reminisce about the good times that they had with their father when they were young ladies or young girls. So it cuts across gender. This is just a father and son thing, which is really cool.
How were you able to finance this trip?
Well, in the final analysis, the cost of this trip is equivalent to probably a good bass boat. Lots of people don't have any trouble buying a new bass boat.
Which costs how much, by the way?
Well, it might cost $25,000, $30,000. So what's it worth to have an experience with your son for 50 days, you know, the summer before he goes off to college that you will never forget? I mean, you could go off and spend that money on a new car or a bass boat and not have a fraction of those memories.
On your website, you also mentioned that Taylor's going to college in the fall was one of the reasons why you've arranged this extraordinary trip. Once he's away, will you have a hard time dealing with that? Will you have a hard time fishing by yourself?
Well, when I planned this trip, I really felt like if I waited until next year, chances of me kind of cornering him would be, you know, almost impossible. So I was really purposeful, I guess, in thinking that this summer was really the last one where time wasn't our enemy, and I felt like we could do that. And hopefully he can appreciate some of it now, and I think when he gets older, he'll appreciate more of it then. But
will you, Taylor? Will you appreciate it down the road?
Yeah, I'd appreciate it quite a bit right now, but I think when I look back on it in the future, it'll mean a lot more to me.
Once you're at college, will it be hard for you to start that stage of your life knowing it's not going to be as easy to get out on the water with your dad as it once was?
He may never want to go out on the water
again.
Yeah,
this is quite a bit of fishing. I might just skip about 5 years.
I don't believe
that. Until I get out of college.
I don't assume you'll fish.
As father and son laugh off Taylor's half-serious declaration, Jim Dowd nods and good-naturedly states his disbelief. He's guided other fathers and sons, and he knows that fishing is one opportunity among the many for them to reconnect. Maybe Dowd and those who have watched the Turners' ambitious and slightly crazy odyssey find it just a little easier to think of that prospect as real and attainable. For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
Taylor Turner had tabulated 484 fish by trip's end, which also meant that he had caught and surpassed Dad, as the young whippersnapper had so boldly predicted that he would. Jeff Turner tallied a scant 472. You can learn more about the Turner's journey by visiting fish5050.com.
I don't mean to preach a sermon, but if you've got a son, take him fishing, take him fishing, be his buddy while he's young.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Gary Wallach's photo gallery featuring the Fishing Turners, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on the program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Taylor Turner of the Warrenton, Virginia Fishing Turners, who reveals their next epic adventure.
Well, we're thinking about doing 11 provinces in 11 days. We might have to get a plane for that, or a helicopter.
Epic father-son adventure, the sequel, Fishing Canada in a Whirlybird. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Now kids grow up so fast, and pretty soon they're gone. Off somewhere raising families of their own. So don't let there be a big long list of those little family outings.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.